Hi, Gary.
Hi, Bob.
How are you?
Good, good.
Good. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV. You are Gary Weber, author of the book Happiness Beyond Thought, A Practical Guide to Awakening. And you also write a blog that I think has the same title. I'm really looking forward to this conversation because I find your case fascinating. Let me try to characterize it and see, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but you're very devoted to contemplative disciplines, meditation, and yoga, although possibly yoga in a different sense than some people think of when they think of yoga.
Right.
You've been a devoted practitioner for many, many years, and you say that you finally got to a point where you kind of, as I understand it, entered a kind of a new zone. You turned the page, as I've heard you put it.
Mm-hmm.
After which it sounds like your ordinary waking consciousness is just very, very different from mine. Not just in the sense that you have an equanimity and that I may sometimes lack, and you are less susceptible to the push and pull of emotions. But I gather that you would say there's a sense in which, the rest of us or most of us think thoughts and are consumed with the thinking of these thoughts, and you basically don't do that. There's like a major category of thinking that you don't do, and that it's liberating that you don't do it.
That's correct.
Okay, so what kinds of thoughts might I have that you just don't, by and large, have?
Well, the way we try to parse out thoughts, and the brain apparently is pretty good at doing this, is most people have this ongoing self-referential narrative that's characterized with an I, me, my, implicitly or explicitly, basically, in every stream of thoughts.
So you mean I'm going, planning what I'm going to do, or worrying that this person doesn't like me or has insulted me, those kinds of thoughts?
But there's a distinction between those first two. I mean, the first one, where we need to plan to meet today at a certain time to have this Skype session, is something that is not emotionally encoded, isn't episodic, is not biographical. And those things, fortunately, and I was surprised by this, can go on. I mean, you can still do a complicated intellectual discussion, you can still plan, you can still problem solve, you can still write. Those are not emotionally charged. The other one you mentioned is, well, oh my goodness, this is really terrible. I was like, the days are really turning out not the way I wanted it to turn out. Things are really bad for me. Those spirals, that's what's gone. So it really has parsed out the emotionally charged, I mean, my thoughts, and left, amazingly, the planning, problem-solving thoughts.
So it's thoughts that are intertwined with emotion that you basically don't have.
Yes.
And that is most thoughts, right? I mean, most thoughts are subtly laden with emotion.
Yeah, the average folk that I've talked to or work with, virtually all of their thoughts, and I've done this with many people, are the I, me, my, emotionally charged, recursive, just never-ending stream of concerns and imagined worries about the future and past, whatever.
Well, what about the example you gave where you do think about the fact that you're supposed to have this conversation with me? Suppose you're caught in traffic and it starts seeming like you're not going to get there in time. Many of us would feel anxiety or something. Do you not feel that?
Not so much. I mean, what went away with the loss of self-referential thoughts? And the idea was, my teacher, Mama Harshi, was to deconstruct this I, me, my. If you can deconstruct that, and what falls away simultaneously, again, it was a surprise to me, with this loss of self-referential thought, this emotionally charged stuff, is all self-referential fears, self-referential anxieties, desires. The self-referential ones that are heavily encoded with longing or emotion are what falls away. And so if you couldn't make it in traffic, you'd be much less inclined to move into thought. You might say, well, I need to get there at 3:15, but you wouldn't transition over into, oh, my God, it's really horrible. I'm going to be late, stuck in traffic. It's going to be a failure. My life's going to turn awfully. You don't go into those.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So how do you fill your conscious time? I mean, if there's all these thoughts that we're not having, what kinds of thoughts are you having?
It's just very still and quiet. There's just nothing going on. See, it isn't, some of the Buddhist texts describe this as being a sunyata, a deep void. There's a lot of misinterpretation. This is an awful, desolate place, an existential wasteland. But in fact, it turns out to be a very sweet place. And one of the things we've tried to work on is how the brain goes about doing this. I mean, it must be putting in some kind of neurotransmitter that gives it this sweet taste at the same time that it's very still.
Mm-hmm.
We have some ideas from some research work at Yale that I've been heavily involved with. That in fact, we have an idea how this network shuts down and how this no-thought place can be maintained. What we don't know, we haven't done the neurotransmitters, is simply dopamine, endogenous dopamine, how that gets submitted or maintained mm-hmm. over the course of the day. Because this goes on all day long, every day.
Okay, we just got cut off, but you were talking about what's going on in the brain, and saying we don't know exactly. We have a sense that there's a region that maybe gets a little shut down, a little mm-hmm. quieter region of the brain, but we don't have the neurotransmitter story totally figured out, and you were mentioning dopamine.
Yeah, yes, the great paper out of Harvard in 2010 in Neuron that detailed this default mode network, which is a network that creates this self-referential blah, blah that goes on and on. And at the Yale machine, at MRI, we can actually watch the key center within those 11 centers and see real time. They've got a real time fMRI. If in fact that center is shut down, the core center is shut down. If it is, then you'll find yourself not in thought. So we really do know the lab. There's a good paper in PNAS about this.
So not in thought, but that only means not in self-referential thought. I mean, you could be saying, what a beautiful mountain. You could have a thought like that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, it would depend how heavy beautiful got. I mean, the thoughts that are problematic are the ones that are described. I work at Hopkins. He describes as being sticky thoughts. I mean, they're thoughts that feel differently. If I say it's a beautiful mountain, it's a fantastically beautiful mountain, this is something that Van Gogh should have painted, then I get rhapsodic about it. It moves over into being a self-referential blah, blah narrative that's emotionally charged. And this network from this Harvard paper, that's a network that can shut down. Now, there is a parallel network, different parts of the brain, that does the problem-solving, problem-phrasing analysis part. That really is discrete from this blah, blah network. And we can watch the blah, blah network shut down. We can watch where it is. We know where it is. And we can watch the other network come back online.
Okay. So you're saying, I gather, that there is a kind of pleasure you can derive via your senses that does not constitute emotional involvement of a problematic kind, or in any event, it doesn't, you're not feeling that kind of emotional involvement.
That's correct. But you haven't lost your nerve endings. I mean, green tea still tastes like green tea. Red wine still tastes like red wine. You don't lose that. What you lose is the carry forward of that sensation. This is a fantastic glass of wine. This is a great year. You start getting into an emotional content about it past just a sensation.
Yeah, but some people would say, if you don't at least say, hey, this is a good glass of wine, then, like, what's the point of living, right? I mean, you must encounter this question, right? I mean, if you're not getting emotionally involved enough to like it, then why be that way?
But it's a much cleaner perception.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I'm tasting a glass of wine and I'm trying to impress some restaurant critic or something, or some friend of mine who's a great wine fancier, then I may have a story going. I may have an expectation for how this wine should be and how I should expect it to taste. And so it really blocks my clear, simple perception of that. And so by getting this thought out of the way, this emotional thought out of the way, I have a much higher likelihood of directly perceiving whatever the sensation is.
Mm-hmm. Anything that would lead to kind of, what Buddhists would call feelings of attachment, a sense of grasping, a sense of, oh, I want more,
right,
that you just don't feel.
It just isn't there.
So it seems so paradoxical to me. You could eat a piece of chocolate and think, oh, that was good chocolate, which you can do, but you don't feel compelled to have more.
Well, it's the point about the Buddhism is good. The idea for me was to see if I could end my suffering, and I found a way to do that, some guidance, and it's exactly that. I had the chocolate was fantastic. I don't have to process any kind of thought about that. Just the very sensory apprehension of that is more than enough, and it's more acute because I'm not clouding it over with my interpretation of it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no movement into interpretation or craving back to it or comparing it to some other piece of chocolate I had in the past. It's just clear perception and then stillness.
So is this the basis for your suspicion that dopamine is involved? Because dopamine does seem to involve in habit formation. It does seem to be involved in wanting more next time.
Yes, we don't know much about it. We're just theorizing about dopamine. It is a good reward. What does happen, surprisingly as well, is that the brain after a while becomes, it likes this quietness, very surprisingly. It finds it more interesting than the alternative.
Mm-hmm.
And this is now my hypothesizing, that in fact, it doesn't like confusion, it doesn't like emotion, it doesn't like running around in a scattered manner. And if you give it enough pictures of this still, clear space, it will eventually neurally repattern. We don't have this absolutely proven, but it's very logical from what we know. So the brain with time just seeks this place. It wants this quiet, still place. And so it's not an effort to force it to stay on point. It just doesn't want to go to a story about chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
It's not interesting to it. It just was going to be in this space. Sensation comes in, apprehension of sensation. There's just no, after that, running off into anything else because it's not as interesting to the brain, if I use that word, as what it is to just be in the stillness. Stillness is so sweet, so pervasive, so compelling that it just stays there.
Mm-hmm. So is your kind of insulation from a lot of ordinary emotional reactions such that I could not make you angry right now? Like if I said, I think you're a fraud, I think you just wanted to make money writing a book, you're just like the rest of us, I don't actually believe that. But if I said it in a credible way where it sounded like a genuine threat, would you have like no emotional response to that?
Well, I don't have any response to what you just said.
Right, but of course I wasn't really saying.
No, there are some limbic fears,
uh-huh,
that are not stopped by this thing, thank goodness. You don't jump in front of buses, you don't step off of cliffs.
Good.
There are some protective fears that the brain does hang on to. Those apparently be different circuits. Now, they aren't mediated circuits. So the unmediated, somebody cuts you off in traffic, you might feel a clenching just for the second it happened. But after that, there's no story. There's no story about, oh, we had this guy do this thing. This is the third guy this week. I'm going to get my shotgun and chase after him. That just doesn't come up. So your primal fears and arguably getting caught off in traffic could be limbic. It's a dangerous situation. You could have gotten hurt,
mm-hmm,
whatever. But then that just stops.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the end of it.
So you can see an attractive, voluptuous woman, assuming you're heterosexual, and note the beauty without actually feeling anything approaching lust or even physical attraction.
Yeah, and that was an interesting thing for me, too, because I enjoyed sex a great deal for a long time. But I'm heterosexual, doesn't matter, it matters. But I can watch my brain still recognize the female shape. It does code on that. I mean, Darwinianly, I believe we code for shape. We code for attractiveness. It was important to us. You're an evolutionary psychologist. You know all this stuff better than I do. But, you know, there isn't any shutting down of that. There's not an effort to come in to shut down natural things like that. What doesn't happen is what you just surmised, is it doesn't carry forward into, oh, she's fantastic, I've got to meet her, you know, I've got to get her phone number, I've got to follow her. But it just doesn't happen. There's just no carrying forward into desire, craving, but there used to be. It's just gone.
Okay. So one more question about your consciousness before I start asking kind of how you got here exactly is, so there's a kind of, what is most of your waking time spent doing? I mean, one could contemplate a number of things without really getting emotionally involved. You can wonder about how we'll try to figure out how to solve the climate change problem. You could wonder who's going to win the next election, I guess, without being emotionally involved, try to do that analysis. You could think about matters having to do with your own career. And I know you've actually had a very, very active career with quite a bit of kind of corporate responsibility, I gather.
Right.
What kinds of thoughts do you have? How do you spend how does your consciousness spend its day?
Well, it's mostly just quiet. But that doesn't preclude. I mean, I was reading today Fred Allen Wolf's latest book, Time Loops and Space Twists, which is one of the current ones for quantum physics. And I just read the book. I was just came off our regional medical board, for example, board trustees. And I would just read the exhibits beforehand. I would learn the information. I would go to the board meetings. I was vice chair, 25, 30 hours a week at the hospital. And I would just come into the meetings empty. I would just sit there quiet and still in the meeting. And something would come up. You know, I read all the exhibits. I knew the information. And just out of seemingly nowhere would come a really creative, insightful answer. Nothing that I had consciously premeditated, but it was better than I could have done if I'd really planned it out myself. I found the same thing in the corporate world. Is that I actually functioned better because in meetings, I'd be the only person who was there. I mean, everybody else was there, you know, some small fraction of the time to medium fraction of the time. But I was the only person that was in the meeting 100%. And there was nothing getting in the way of any insight coming up into space, into this consciousness to be voiced out. There was no interference about, well, what Finn said last time, and you know, Bob's trying to really do me in on this thing. That just wasn't there. And so you're much more efficient, much more effective than I was before, where I had these thoughts going on all the time.
And what go ahead.
No, to me, it was functionally enhancing. Mm-hmm. I really expected going in, I was risking losing everything. I was a knowledge broker, and the very concept of losing my ability to reason was really a big concern for me, not to be the case at all.
And what exact line of work have you been in? What has been the nature of your vocational responsibilities?
Well, I was an empirical physical scientist, PhD, national lab for 5 years. Then for 20 years, I was in three different companies, most of my time in GE, managing large R&D organizations, running some small companies within that purview, senior vice president of the company in Pittsburgh. So, a lot of responsibility. When the page turned for me and my thoughts stopped, I had 1,000 people working for me, $250 million budget, and 4 research labs. I had no thoughts. And so it arose that, my gosh, what's going to happen when I go to work today? And it turns out nothing happened. Nothing bad happened. Nobody recognized it.
Did people notice a difference?
No. I thought, but they're going to see, some terrible thing. But no, nobody even noticed anything.
Well, you seem to me, and maybe it's just always impossible to imagine people as other than what they are at the moment, but you kind of seem to me like somebody who would have always had a kind of detached scholarly air, right? I mean, I don't imagine you ever having been like Woody Hayes or,
No. I didn't throw chairs or jump out on the field or anything. No. Yeah. So there was no dramatic change whatsoever. Nobody even put comment on it.
Yeah, okay. But you felt something. You felt you had passed through a threshold after really decades of contemplative practice that presumably featured some what you would call progress, I guess. Mm-hmm. You felt you really had passed through a threshold.
It was dramatic. I did my practices in the morning, like 2 hours before I went to work every day for 25 years. And I had a lot of busy jobs, a lot of traveling and stuff. I just got those 2 hours in. I was doing a series of yoga postures. I do them in a kind of a hooked together flowing manner. And I went up into this one posture one way, thoughts going to the, and it just stopped. Absolutely just stopped. And I came down, and the whole world had changed.
And it has stayed that way.
It stayed that way for 14 years, 15 years. The only caveat is that when my blood sugar gets very low, I'm hypoglycemic, or if I get very tired, thoughts can start again. And that's my best indication that I have one of those problems, is that my thoughts are starting. And first thing in the morning, about the first 20, 25 minutes, two phenomena seem to occur. One is that if there's been a problem I've been working on, the solution has been worked on offline, will often pop up first thing in the morning. I'm trying to write something, and the next chapter will just kind of pop up as an idea into my consciousness, the next blog post. And that's that's there first thing in the morning. There's also, and this is the hippocampus, kind of deciding, is it from short-term memory, do we want to bother to keep yesterday's things that happened to you might have recorded, or do we want to just dump them? And if you don't take delivery on any of those remembrances, they're just thrown away. But there is that first 15, 20 minutes in the morning, which seems to be the brain downloading the work from yesterday.
Okay. So you were doing 2 hours of practice every morning. I mean, mm-hmm. practice in the Buddhist sense. You're calling it yoga. I gather it involved something that these days yoga doesn't typically involve, which is also kind of meditation. Is that right?
That's right. And the first 1 hour was basically Zen meditation.
Okay.
I went off into Zen very early, and I did what they call self-inquiry. Who am I? Where am I? What is this? Who here is? Which are classical Rinzai Zen questions. I had a couple Rinzai Zen masters on the East Coast that I worked with. The yoga, though, was kind of a flowing, putting postures together, really meditative yoga, which is very different than the Deva Guru right now in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And if you were sticking with it for all those years, there was something good about the results even before the results became this dramatic, right? How would you describe what the benefits were, what kept you at it for all those years?
Quite honestly, I don't know what kept me at it so hard for so long. I just knew at some level I had to do it.
You don't know why? I mean, there wasn't some kind of dissatisfaction with your state of consciousness?
Well, I mean, the whole thing started. I was in graduate school walking down towards campus, and I just saw that my mind was just racing. And I wasn't solving the cure to cancer or anything. It was just racing, just the usual garbage. And something, you know, one of those epiphanous moments of, this can't be the way it's supposed to be. There has to be a better way than this. So I set off to try to find it. I knew I was suffering, but it wasn't so much that Buddhist perspective. It was just unsatisfactory. And so I was trying to find a way to end this never-ending stream of thoughts. And I set about doing that, and I was fortunate enough to find the right people and do the right practice for a long time. But I knew I wanted rid of them.
And what benefits did you notice along the way before you reached this threshold?
Honestly, I don't recall it. I mean, I did it for 25 years, but it wasn't like I was keeping a diary and logging in, I had 3 good things happen today and nothing happened yesterday. Because that, to me, pedagogically, was not useful. I mean, if I'm logging in how I did today, mm-hmm. then I become somebody who tries to generate something to log in for today.
Right. This is, of course, the paradox that you encounter. I've done a few silent meditation retreats, and there's always this, you know, there's no goal, you know, mm-hmm. and yet, well, wait a second, I came here for something, you know.
Right, exactly.
And you can argue about that all day, whether there is or is not a goal. But it is certainly true that as a practical matter, abandoning the idea of a goal can be useful mm-hmm. in making progress, I've found.
And that's what I found, too, is that if I were totally goal-focused as a doer trying to get to an endpoint, that was a different objective than just trying to get as clear as possible and get the eye deconstructed as much as possible. But I had events along the way that were encouraging, but they became more distractions. I mean, I had some big openings, but if you aren't careful and you attach to those, you try to replicate them, and some doer comes in to make that take place again, it really is tremendously counterproductive.
Right. I mean, on the one hand, I gather you're saying that if there's some state, meditative state, you get attached to and seek, sit down trying to attain, that's not the idea. On the other hand, I would assume there was something that felt good about the meditation if you kept at it all these years, but you're not sure whether there was?
And I've been asked that many times. I can't really honestly say that I was noticing big changes. I just know it wasn't done yet. I would go see my Zen masters from time to time, and they would say, no, you know, go work more. And I could tell it wasn't done because it didn't feel like it was complete. Mm-hmm. Even if I had openings and insights, you could still feel there was something there that wasn't done yet. Mm-hmm. So I just kept going back and going back and going back until it was clear that it was over.
Mm-hmm. So do you think your experience has vindicated the fundamental claim of Buddhism that the source of human suffering is attachment, is you know, the grasping at things, the seeking of things that you think will bring you pleasure and the clinging to things?
Absolutely, but that was necessary but not sufficient. I mean, the path I was on is much more a thing called direct path, which is the self-inquiry thing. I was a Zen Buddhist, but it was big Z and small b. And my one teacher was very iconoclastic. She had risen to the top of the Zen hierarchy, and she'd walked away from it. So she was very—I was also an iconoclast. She was very useful to me in that perspective. And I would check back in with her and back in with my other Zen teacher, and they'd say, "No, that's not it." But I knew it wasn't it anyway. So I just kept on going.
Okay, but you now are a person pretty much free of attachment.
Yeah.
Okay. And there's another fundamental Buddhist concept you alluded to when you mentioned the deconstruction of self. There is this mm-hmm. idea in Buddhism that the self doesn't exist, which strikes most people as counterintuitive, to say the least. In passing through this threshold, do you feel you have experienced the truth that the self does not exist and experience that every day?
Yeah, and it really is. We've confirmed this now, called them neuroscientifically. I didn't know this when my thing happened, but there was absolutely that sense. And you get at it pedagogically by going after your attachments. I mean, you can feel every place you're attached. And what you do, what I did, was methodically go after every place I could feel I was attached. And I would just go into those places and visit them, move into them, inquire. You just deconvolute every attachment. You don't have to do every single one of, you know, all the winds you ever had. You just need to deconvolute that particular kind of attraction, and it seems like that whole kind of network collapses.
So you did that through meditation? You mean you would observe yourself yearning for something, and the observation would weaken the hold that this had on you, or what?
Absolutely. The last thing I was let go of was my daughters. I was really attached to my daughters, and I had this feeling they were just getting into school and graduate school and college and graduate school, and I would not surrender that attachment until I was certain they were comfortable and safe. And once they got into schools and it was enough money for them to get through, then I let go of everything. But I could feel the attachment to my daughters, and I knew that had to go.
Well, what about when you see them now? Does that mean you don't feel the feelings of love that parents normally feel?
Not in the way I felt them before, but I find I'm arguably a better parent now because I don't have an agenda for them. I don't have a preconception of how they should turn out. And I'm very supportive of them, but I don't feel attached to them in the way I used to feel attached to them, or guilty about their behavior or proud of their behavior. I just don't have those feelings.
Would you say you love them in a way you don't love people outside of your family?
Honestly, I have to say no.
Wow.
That's kind of a downside to this whole discussion. I mean, it follows logically, but it wasn't something that I expected. But it is a self-referential attachment, and if you are attached to them, then that's going to, you know, pull that in, and I don't feel that, honestly.
Yeah, well, I mean, it complies with Buddhist doctrine. It's not a surprise in that sense, right? It's a known kind of consequence of taking the doctrine seriously, you know, and in a certain sense of a number of other ethical systems. I mean, mm-hmm. If you're a utilitarian, you're supposed to think that every human's welfare is equally important, which means you should not devote any more resources to your children's welfare than to anyone else's, or your own welfare than anyone else's.
That's correct, and I don't feel that. But I also don't feel like I do good. I mean, I don't have a sense of doing good or doing bad or being compassionate. I just do with a full attention whatever comes in front of me to be done. And I'm not worried about what comes after that, if it was the right thing or the wrong thing. It turns out, to the person, it feels much more appropriate and useful. I don't have any sense of owning the outcome of that person's improvement or lack of improvement.
So by ceasing to care about doing good, you've done more good in conventional terms. That's not your own judgment. You don't make those judgments anymore, but you know what I mean.
That's presumably, yes. And I find things have opened up in unimaginable ways just by being present and not having an agenda. Really better than I could have ever have fantasized about things turning out.
Mm-hmm. And the reason you have better effects than you used to have is because your own kind of self-interest is not warping your interactions with humans.
Absolutely. It's like Woody Allen. You know, it's just most of life you're showing up. But if you're showing up 100%, then it really does get a lot better. I mean, you're so much in the now. And this now, which is so cliche in Zen and all throughout Buddhism and other disciplines, it becomes automatic because there's no place else in your consciousness you would rather be than where you are right now.
Okay.
So there's no running off into some fantasy about something else.
Okay. There's a line in the introduction to your book related to this. It says basically something like, the bad news is that you don't exist. The good news is that you're everything.
Hmm.
What does that part mean?
Well, it's kind of a logical consequence. I mean, if you're nothing, if you disappear, you can then be everything. But you can't be everything unless you are nothing. It just logically follows that's the case. The everything case isn't as obvious, but if you are nothing, instead of just disappearing and becoming a void, you find out that in some strange way, and you actually see this, you perceive it this way, that everything is all one thing. This is a cliche, mystical statement, but it really is perceptible. I mean, you can deeply sense that everything is all one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's somehow, strangely, it's inside of you.
Yeah. I mean, I would say I have had a meditative experience where the bounds of myself, in a certain sense, suddenly seemed a lot more permeable.
Absolutely.
That is like the place where the bird's song enters my body, my sensory apparatus, no longer seemed like such a fine dividing point, you know, and things like that.
Exactly.
But that's very, but I don't, you know, that was like a one-time brief experience, not sure what to make of it. You're saying that as you walk around every day, are you saying that you in a way, identify with everyone else as much as you identify with yourself?
Yeah, I would say that it's a little different from that, but that's not far different. I don't identify with anything. I mean, there's just nobody here to identify with either me or with anybody else. It's just an empty steel presence here, which is there.
So the problem with saying you identify with everyone is the very beginning of the sentence, you.
Exactly, because there's no you there to do the identifying.
On the other hand, to say that you are everyone, is that a more acceptable way to put it?
Well, but it's equally incorrect.
Oh, all right, I still started with you. How can I do this?
That's the problem. And I tried for a while to language this correctly, and almost all the human languages are subject-object, you know, verb based. So it gets so cumbersome and so affectatious almost to not use pronouns.
Mm-hmm.
I just default to the normal language.
Okay. So is it possible to describe the subjective feeling of selflessness any more than you've already described it?
Well, I couldn't. I mean, I had read a bunch of stuff over the course of 25 years. But what actually happened, what it's like, was nothing like what I expected it to be. Because it is inherently transcendent. And I mean, just by definition, it's something that you cannot anticipate or grasp through the mind. I mean, the mind runs around while you get openings earlier and tries to recreate it. And his ego's terribly unsuccessful at doing that. So when you finally do reach this space, I mean, there are all kinds of words we try to language. I've used words like empty fullness or full emptiness, or it's a space you can't imagine bringing anything in to improve it or taking anything away that would make it any better. Mm-hmm. It just is an absolute, complete, satisfied, full space.
Okay. But there does continue to be, even if you don't like words like I, there continues to be a vantage point from which you are perceiving things. And it is in some sense inside your head, right?
Not so much. That isn't how it goes. What happens is you can feel the perceiver be at some level of identification, some concreteness. And with time, the perceiver gets smaller and smaller and less discrete until it eventually just basically fuzzes away. There's still a URL, a locator, a GPS thing, so you don't bump into furniture. And people can still call out your name and you can respond and you can still do your daily tasks. But as far as a perceiver, when I try to feel back now into where the perceiver is, I can't find a place where there's a vantage point from which perceiving occurs. Mm-hmm. Perception still occurs, and it would logically follow. I couldn't tell you about it unless there was something there seeing this, but it doesn't feel that way as I look at you right now.
Okay. Now, the state you've reached, I assume that it's kind of a known state, in the sense that if you look at the Buddhist literature, you would find references to it and attempts maybe to describe it, and that if you talk to Buddhist monks, whether or not they feel they've gotten there, and these are monks who meditate, which not all Buddhist monks actually do, but in other words, if you talk to really devoted, serious practitioners who are plugged into the literature, they would, there's a term you could use to describe where you are, and they'd go, oh, well, congratulations, or something, you know. In other words, it's not like you describe this, and all these serious practitioners go, whoa, you've gone off the deep end, or you've reached a new level. This is like a known state with a name?
It varies from discipline to discipline and how it's described. When I describe this not having any thought state, that's not very common. It's not unheard of within the disciplines, within the lineages that I practiced, Ramana Maharshi, Jagadguru Maharaj, Rinzai Zen people. Mm-hmm. It's not unprecedented. I'm not the first person in the history of mankind to have this thing happen.
Are there notable figures who seem to have described the same thing?
Well, the people I mentioned, Ramana Maharshi, who was 1879 to 1950 in South India, Nisargadatta Maharaj, also another non-dualist, they describe these exactly, as near as you can describe it. So it isn't unprecedented, it's just not common.
And that's another thing you've experienced, which is related to selflessness, but is non-dualism.
Right. And that's inherent. I mean, it also follows logically. When you deconstruct the I, the place you fall into is non-duality, and if there's nobody there, then this is what happens.
Okay. And non-duality is particularly emphasized in the Zen tradition, I gather, of the various Buddhist meditative traditions.
The Buddhist ones, yes. Dzogchen. I don't know much about Dzogchen, but Dzogchen is supposed to also be very similar to this. I've heard some Dzogchen people speak, and they use the same words that Ramana Maharshi uses to speak about this state. So I assume they've got the same endpoint. I've heard they do, but they've really talked about Ramana Maharshi, no thoughts was a big goal for him.
Mm-hmm. Now, another theme in Buddhism is that reality, as ordinarily perceived, is in some sense an illusion. Does that resonate with you? Do you think, looking back, well, in some sense, I was in a dream world before I took up the practice?
Well, I mean, right now, as I look out the window, I can see a snowy day scene, and it looks unreal to me. I mean, at some, this is a strange thing, some perceptive level, I know that it's not real. I mean, it does not look like it used to look, and as I can recall back that many years ago, and it has this feeling of unreality. It's hard to voice that, but I know it's not true.
You mean of intangibility? Like yes, the pixels are impinging on your eye or whatever, the light rays, but there's some sense in which it's not out there?
Well, I mean, the movie is running, but...
That's what I mean. Is it just a movie?
It's just a movie. It's really just a movie.
But that's not the same as saying that, say, the people you see are not people with real feelings, right?
Well, they are part of the movie. I mean, they may have real feelings in the movie. They may be experiencing real things in the movie, and real catastrophes and life changes and all that, but they're just part of the movie.
Well, they're part of your movie, but aren't they also seeing their own movie?
Well, that's the quantum physics discussion, and the answer is yes. I mean, even from some of the best science we have, we all have our own movies.
Okay. I mean, one thing we're kind of backing into, which you started approaching earlier when you talked about losing your attachment to your daughters, is that Buddhism sometimes gets accused of being nihilistic. That is to say, believing in no values in the sense in which moral systems usually believe in values, like utilitarianism values human welfare and therefore human life. And there is the possibility with Buddhism of taking the doctrine so far that you think nothing matters. Would you say you've gone that far?
Nothing matters. But I have no sense. I was a very deterministic person before the page turn. I believe I had created my world and I had made everything happen that was in my world. And once I didn't have an eye, then there was nobody there. Obviously, there was nobody there in control. There was nobody to have free will. So it became apparent to me, and that's been borne out, that in fact I never did have control, and I don't have control now. So there isn't, you know, a sense of sin or karma. You know, there's no feeling that I'm responsible for anything. And it doesn't go the way people expect it to go. I mean, it turns out that you don't behave amorally any more than you did before. I mean, life just goes on as it goes on. You just lost the perception, in fact.
Okay, we just suffered another Comcast interruption, but which is your carrier. I'm assigned, although you no longer assign blame to things, I do, so this was your fault because Comcast.
Okay.
You were saying that you don't, I think you were saying you don't behave any more amorally than you did before. I mean, even though we were saying, well, we were asking, is Buddhism nihilistic and in that sense amoral? And you were saying you don't think it's made you, I think you were saying you don't think it's made you a worse person. I mean, we were saying earlier that by conventional moral reckoning, it's made you a better person in terms of the effects you have on other people's welfare.
Presumably. But my point being that I no longer have a sense of behaving a certain way by a certain template so that I can get karma points or sin points or good behavior points. That just has gone as a motivation for me to have some special code of ethics. I mean, I find I don't behave amorally because, you know, if everything is one thing and we're all in this together, not all of us, but if everything is one thing, then why should I do something if there wasn't either to do it, to perturb this? Why would I do something bad to you?
Okay.
Or be afraid of doing something because I'd be punished later. I have no sense of future punishment or future reward.
Okay. And it would strike some people as ironic that presumably you are really, you're kind of no longer concerned with whether people consider you a good or a bad person, and yet you behave no worse than you did when you were concerned with that, and arguably you behave better in some sense.
Yeah, that's correct. Arguably better. And certainly there's no angst internally about behavior and as far as motivation in the past, you know, I relied upon all kinds of don't do this and do that, and I find those to have not been useful for me anyway. So I find them not to be even existent now. I don't have any sense of that whatsoever.
Okay. And do you feel feel affection for other humans and animals, or a kind disposition toward them, or what Buddhists call metta or loving kindness? What some Buddhists call metta or loving kindness?
I find I'm drawn to babies. I find babies fantastic, and I love animals. I find love animals a lot. Nature, I love a lot. I mean, I'm drawn to, I'm drawn to babies. I don't know why. I'm just very drawn to little babies. And I'm drawn to dogs. I like dogs a lot. I'm drawn to dogs.
I'm with you on those two. And I think the flip side, which is that you're less drawn to other adults, I'm probably with you on as well. but one difference might be that it's actually, I mean, it's also, I mean, you know, I go through life and at times I feel very warmly toward an adult. Or, you know, when you feel you have a common interest or, you know, things are going well. And I might, you know, all too easily feel hostility toward another adult. You just feel much less of both of those things.
That's correct. Yeah. That's correct. Yeah, and I very seldom go to either end. I mean, it very seldom happens that I move to, I dislike somebody intensely, mm-hmm. or I, you know, I'm really drawn to somebody.
Okay, so it is largely a passionless life, but not a life devoid of enjoyment.
It's very pleasant. I mean, my internal space ongoing. We've done some studies on this thing, and as far as comparing this state, which I've got some people moving into now, compared to psychedelics or compared to orgasm, I mean, they pick this state over either of the other two, even serotonergic psychedelics.
What about orgasm while on psychedelics?
Well, that's the question that always comes up. What about orgasm on psychedelics with memorable consorts in this state? Well,
yeah.
Whatever. But to me, there's no, as I said earlier, there's no motion out of this space towards those things. There's no great desire. People, even Johns Hopkins is running a study right now on psilocybin, plus or minus meditation for experienced people.
Yeah, I saw that on your blog, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, some really good people at Hopkins doing some really nice work down there. And he said, why don't you come down and do psilocybin? I said, well, there's no interest for me to do it. I'm a virgin on psychedelics. And so why would I move into that? It might screw something up. And there's no upside. It's not better than what I have here. Because all people I know who've done psychedelics say, no, this thing is better than psychedelics, so you don't need to do it. So I just haven't done it.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, this has been fascinating.
Okay.
Congratulations.
No, I don't, whatever.
you're the alpha Buddhist, man.
Way
to
no,
go.
No,
you're better. No, you're better than the other Buddhists. Come on.
No, I don't know that at all.
Get attached to this. Come on. Okay. Well, this has really been fascinating. And maybe you'll come back and talk to us again. This was fun.
Okay, thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.